of all, I just have to own up that I didn't write this poem, and because it's Christmas and stuff, it's a Christmas theme, and it's actually a poem that my mum, she made a Christmas card for me one year, and she put this poem in the Christmas card, and forgive me if I get emotional now and again, but I'll try and read it out for you. It was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, everyone felt shitty, even the mouse. Mum at the whorehouse, Dad smoking grass, and I just settled down to a nice piece of ass. When out on the lawn I heard such a clatter, I sprang from my piece to see what was the matter. Then out on the lawn I saw Big Dick, and I knew in a moment it must be Saint Nick. He came down the chimney like a bat out of hell. I knew right away that the fucker had fell. He filled all our stockings with pretzels and beer, and a big rubber dick for my brother the queer. He rose up the chimney with a thunderous fart, and the son of a bitch blew the chimney apart. He cursed and he swore as he rode out of sight. Piss on you all and have a hell of a night. Money's short, times are hard. Now here's your fucking Christmas card.
Happy Christmas to you too, Grant. Next up, can we please welcome Colin Scully.
Staying with the Christmas theme, and this is a Christmas poem. It's called Christmas Crackers. Putting crackers on the table on Christmas Day. Margaret tumbles backwards following the explosion. Uncle Jackson's joyful face cracks half a smile. The guy goes flying, landing on Granny's plate, prompting the story being thrown headlong from the handlebars of her bike. The story's lost amidst the white meat and the brown, the feigning nods of interest. There's still one cracker in the box. As Rosie reads the grimy tale of young Thomas Smith, inventor of gimmicks to the Queen. He, a most unpalatable character, brought Christmas crackers to the London party scene in late November 1847. While Granny's granddad shoveled earth on paupers' graves and knackeries, and Uncle Jack's great uncle bucked the trend and lived, though all his siblings died in Hungry Cork. But Tom Smith's trendy crackers made a splash across the water. Vicky and Albert pulled one after tea at Buckingham. Such giggles as the tricks went spinning, all around were laughing as Albert placed the paper crown upon his head. The famine queen just smirked, and maybe winced, the thoughts of those in far off Ireland. Back here in Cork, there's one to pull. Perhaps I boycott as a solemn gesture to all the millions dead. The hand of friendship reaches across the table, urging me. Pull! Don't pull for Ireland, I think. I pull. It's time to let it go. This blaming England for all of Ireland's woes.
Next up, we have Mary O'Connell.
This is not a Christmas poem. It's called A Chip of the Old Block. He appeared on TV3, flustered when he couldn't find a tie. A busy man, thin as a whippet, polishing his shoes in the small hours by the light of an open fire. The cap, his badge of office. Would the sight of Michael Healy raise a laugh? It might, if you were what he'd call a city slicker. Still, the tribal dynasty that put Kilgarvan on the map are known to be outstanding in their field, even in the kingdom where fields abound. Easy to label them cute whores, mimic the accent they refuse to hide. Easy to dismiss the Healy clan as headless chickens scrabbling for a vote. Being an independent in the Doyle, Michael doesn't have the clout his daddy had. when Jackie got that million for the roads to keep him sweet with Bertie's cabinet. So Michael has to cultivate his patch. If your house needs double glazing, or your medical's card's been revoked, he'll do his level best to put things right. Back in the day when celebrities went wild, he won. But who made all the calls? He refuses to get bogged down in disputes concerning turf. The locals have a right to help themselves. If you criticise his stance, he'll tell you, 'tis all bull, plain as the one that services my cows. Michael's hectic schedule has him racing everywhere, often putting in a 12-hour day. Whatever the occasion, hatching, matching, or dispatching, he'll pull out all the stops to show his face. He was once in such a hurry, he tried note-taking while driving, a misdemeanor broadcast far and wide. When cornered by reporters, he refused to bow his head. No one mentioned what speed the vehicle was travelling. The thing was barely moving at the time. Some think Chachtadola stands for temperamental dickhead. But you couldn't, in all fairness, call him that. He's a man who's got his finger on the pulse of his constituents, but their palms might become itchy when they come to vote again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. I should have said earlier that tonight the All-Ireland Slam Championships were held in Connacht in Galway. And Julie Goo, who's a regular here, she came third this year. So through the final. Next up, could we ask Charles Clark to the stage, please?
Been in Kilgarvan, but I do know that there was a very famous man from that part of the world who turned off the lights in New York some years ago, Red Mike Quinn, also from a political dynasty that is known to us, and it is thought that he did something for fertility in New York alongside that. Famously. Now this has got nothing to do with that. It's a very short thing about Christmas still. It's media. It's a reflection on media. Christmas still. It is a good studio practice to pose the Indian on the water tower with bow and arrow against the blue desert sky. Skeletal tree and ranch sign, a Christmas card from the west, a mannequin message of good and evil from the back lot.
Thanks, Charles. And the next we have our five-word challenge winner of the evening, Simon Aronson.
This is called Blubber. The cancer returns to the organ's wall, heralded by rivers of blood. The tumour, smaller than before, a quick response to a call. Pop in, have a look around and clean up, said in good humour. A weak anaesthetic fails to stem the waves of pain, the body invaded. Cauterized, short, sharp shock.
Okay.
okay, that's not moving where it's meant to go. Okay, there'll be discomfort for a few weeks for all to settle down again. Chemo's catheter course complete, another day and ready to rock. 4 months, shall we say, leaving no pause for the unspoken, unless the virulent blighter forces a return quicker. The course we need to follow will not be broken. Not a good idea to use this, it takes too long to go down. Enjoy the time you have pain-free, you're going to get sicker. Time's rubber band, cat's cradle stretched around interested fingers waiting to snap apart. The mortal call that keeps us from being late dispatched to the final stage of life cycled back to the start. Sorry about that, and I won't use technology again.
Thank you, Simon. And next, delighted to welcome back a very old friend of our Vale who we haven't seen in ages, Paddy Doyle.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be back. This poem begins with a memory of saving turf when the family bought the home.
Called Box On.
The cut turf laid out in rows. Black serpents trailed across the bog, and all of us stood side by side as we turned the glistening sods and stacked them two on two, until we built a tower of eight, then wanted to crown it off, and all about the scent of heather wafting on the breeze, and the purple silence deepened by a thousand humming bees. Tourist buses pass along the road and honk their horns. Cameras flash as we, half proud and half ashamed, stand up and wave. Glimpse our photos framed on foreign walls, relics of a vanquished age. Our roots sunk deep into the past, our souls, bog holes, as deep and dark as the secrets they drown. This bog I'm sunk in now, this vast, frightful darkness, this black wave pressing on me from all sides until the shell I have become cracks from the pressure. I wish someone would slice down with a schlam and heist me up to the clear air, where I might hear the birds sing and feel my heart open to their music. If I could hear the sound of water whooshing over shingles, it would heal the cracks in my mind and I would be whole again, my balance found, my poise regained. But I've sunk too low, no living thing can reach me now. I've strayed too far from all I've known, stretched my roots until they snapped and shriveled, wrapped themselves around my tongue, so I cannot sing of who I am, of who I was born to be, as Smith forging shrines to preserve his people's memory. It could be lifetimes before they find me, millennia, a piece of bog oak buried beneath 5,000 years of peat, an old thing from which to carve a sculpture, a turf cutter maybe, or some other image of long ago. It will be all that is left of us, a wild keen echoing through the halls of time, an old air that no one remembers the words to, or it might simply be thrown on a fire and burned, a final flaring before the void swallows us forever. So what to do? Go home, become enmeshed again in the root tangle of family, let your soul be rewoven into the web you struggled so hard to escape from. Drink from the well of inherited stories, wash your vision clean with the clear waters of their wisdom. Let your words wet their words flower in your tongue, and one day you will have food to give them, to nourish them and turn through the long dark dream that is winter. Go home, they'll take you in. And though there might be worry of your brokenness, fear not, for I come to know that you walk through darkness, so others might live by your light.
Thank you for that, Paddy. And next we have Seamus Harrington.
Thanks, Paul.
trouble here. Free downloads. They've altered my application, activated my archives, booted my browser, buried my broadband, bookmarked my bits, connected my console, captured my cartridge, clicked on my cookies, commandeered my cursor, dropped down my devices, delved in my downloads, documented my data, dragged out my driver, displayed my desktop, erased my errata, encrypted my emails, fancied my favorites, fumbled my floppy, fragmented my fonts, firewalled my folders, gorged on my gigabytes, grouped up my game ports, hijacked my hardware, hacked at my hyperlink, hung out my homepage, hosted my hard drive, inserted my icon, interrupted my intranet, jellied my Java, jumpered my jacklug, keystroked my kernel, kneaded my knickknacks, logged on my laptop, labeled my language, massaged my poor mouse, merged with my modem, minimized my monitor, muddled my memory, memorized my moniker, negated my network, networked my nonsense, opened my outputs, outsourced my options, plagiarized my process, programmed my printer, punctured my pop-ups, partitioned my password, queried my QWERTY, questioned my query, quoted my quandary, raided my right-click, recycled my registry, selected my software, sampled my startup, serviced my smart drive, scheduled my scanner, sentenced my shortcuts, trespassed my trackball, trojaned my toolbar, uncovered my uploads, underlined my undo, violated my version, vetoed my vectors, vented my volumes, wormed in my window, winkled my wizard, X-rated my excerpts, yawned at my yarns, zeroed my zip drive. Thank you.
And you've survived all of that. Well done, James. Lovely girl. Please, could we now call Patricia Walsh to the mic?
Thank you, Paul. This isn't a Christmas poem, but it comes pretty close. It's called Prologue for the New Year. New style, effective for a while, and years and years and years of gears into Singlish, caged and braided for later years and years and years of artificial engines in their own blood and honesty. Party at the wrong time to test what we think is best. The goddess stews in her own candlelight, and the clawing of the eyes of the sweet has fallen in Charlotte. The new centre of the barge, reinstating the bore of nothing to do at all with every twist from the face, an angle from the armless, the wavelengths have drowned. And the red rebels obsoleted, milk the bells that have foretold. I have been very, very bold. Sweeping from shores, and every weeping and its claws and consequences in the dark falls from softness in cold wall as a part of one span in the mist and a crisis all over the state where sisters will break for its own water's sake. Thanks.
Thank you, Trish. And next up to the mic is Billy Randall.
Hey. This is a poem I'm working on at the moment, set in a magical wonderland fantasy kingdom called Barcelona. We will make a fine stew, a broth of albondigas, of rabbit and wine. I am writing this next to the recipe. It will simmer lasciviously all silken currants on your battered stove's one good hob. Its pheromones will season the living room and snap the cat's spine into an arc of predation on their wanton way to the balcony. I sit on the balcony and imagine you're coming. You are coming with a tray of tomatoes, mushy whorls, yielding globules, irregular in their skin-straining fleshiness. You sashay through Del Carme's magenta evening, through its narrow crepuscular breathing, past hipsters and immigrants, past dive bars and curry joints, under each watching macho balcony. The fruit that you carry is lividly crimson. The cobbles are almost blue. Overdressed for this desultory Sunday, in flannel and retro check, in your own best alterations, your absurd heels click on the cobbles. I can hear you approach through the diminishing din. A black hawker beats out on his butane can in a happy advertisement towards the square. Or can I hear you? We will listen, wine-drenched and nourished, to the barrio humming. We will make a fine stew. I have peeled 4 yellow onions. I have borrowed this pen from Antonio Gonzalez Gonzalez.
Thank you, Billy. And next we have Rab Burkhart.
I was going to do a Scottish poem, but I forgot to bring it. I was going to do To a Haggis by Riley Burns, but there you go. So I just have to drag one out of my memory. So this is about me and my girlfriend having a fight. It's called Me and My Tiger. My tiger spat and scratched and swore. She beat the ground, let out a mighty roar. With whisker stiff and talons sharp, she scared me silly, she scared me daft. She chased me up and down a tree, and just when I thought that I was free, she lashed me with her velvet claw and rattled all the teeth in my lower jaw. I wasn't standing for that. I nearly punched her back right on the nose, but from her eyes the tears they flowed. She stood her ground and she growled loud. I turned around and I jumped about and I flew as fast as I could flee right up to the top of a great big tree. But when I stopped and looked back down to the ground, there wasn't any sign there was a tiger around. I quickly shinned back down the tree. I searched as far as I could see. I looked up here, I looked down there. At last, I found my tiger's lair. It was a cave full of bright and beautiful things, with chests of gold and diamond rings and human skulls with teeth and hair. There was many a marvellous thing in there. Just then, I saw where the tiger lay, upon a bed of straw and fresh hay, the tears still coursing down her cheeks. She looked like she hadn't slept for weeks, but I crept in close with a quiet glide, and I lay me down there by her side, and she looked at me, and I could see this tiger woman really loved me. Tiger's eyes burning bright like a white moon on a black, black night. Tiger woman so graceful and fair. I love tigers because tigers dare.
Thank you, Rab. Next, we have Cedric Bicon.
It's called Reap and Sow. Every morning, I break the nightly fast. I do a prayer to the earth over my bowl, and no over the oat. From dawn to dusk, that's what a day truly lasts. Be quick on the harvest. Think. One thing cannot be afforded is a lack of wit. Mistakes are fine. There is no time to cry over a spilled rice. It's a day after day job on the field. You plow through your time, sow your crop. It's a day-to-day job in gathering non-serial successes through the successive, sometimes brandless actions. I was promised a better life, an affirmation poorly spelled. I will never trust again a corny cross-seller who probably have eaten more rye bread than his death. Every morning, I break the nightly fast, sorry. I do a prayer to the earth over my bowl, an oath to the old. I reap what I sow, content with whatever will grow. Both ground and heart can be soiled by greed. I will reap what I sow, happy with whatever will grow. I will sow both grass and weed.
Thank you, Cedric. Next up, I think it's Samir Usherbni. The first time to announce Samir.
Thanks. All my experience as a writer was as a rapper. I was a rapper as a teenager, and even though I haven't rapped in 5 years, all my poems become raps. So-called poems, they're raps. Another day, another crime. Sins upon sins. My whole life is a lie to try to hide the villain's pin. She could be my truest friend, the only one who stays around, in my lonesome Spartan garret, in my threadbare redoubt. My regout is stained with blood, the blood I shed for her. It mingles with the tears that flood to work to quell the hurt. But my pains are vast and formless, like the oceans on day one. Genesis, de profundis, miles across and aeons long. When she enters me, she burns me, and I smile at that relief. It heralds temporary peace, like from a child that's given sweets. But my pax is riven, cracked and cursed, because cravenly I seek it. I'm a ghost who haunts my former life with melancholy secrets. I'm a shadow of the me that could have been but never was. Family's dreams squashed beneath my liquid koshed galosh. Sometimes when she and I unite, I wish that this is it. That she'd close my eyes for good and send me across the river Styx. Thank you.
Thank you, Samir. So we've come to our last poet of the night, of the year, in fact. So thanks, it's been a great one. We are going over to Mainz afterwards for some afters. You're welcome to come and join us there. So for the last poet of the night, could we call on Christy Parker, please?
That was a good year anyway, so I usually read poetry when I come up here, but I'm going to make a change to my normal procedure, and I'm going to read a little short story tonight instead. It's the first time I've ever read this, actually, to an audience. But it's also Christmas themed, but it's, as well as that, ironically, as it happens sometimes, life imitates art, and it's got resonance as well to our guests tonight and the theme of immigration and not belonging, etc. That'll be in a temporary manner. Okay. Now, as history repeats itself with a vengeance, many of us recall the enforced departures that saw us unpack our bags in foreign rooms in the 1980s. Nostalgia is selective, of course, and what once may have seemed cold and uncertain acquires a warmer glow with time. Christmas, in particular, ignites the memories. Before Ryanair, the likes of Aer Lingus were expert practitioners of the attitude that would define the Celtic Tiger. They charged exorbitant prices. At Christmas, they increased them. Consequently, coach and boat was the dominant mode of transport for immigrants to London, even if every journey took 10 times longer, while conversely reducing one's life expectancy by a year. In the mid-1980s, I had formed an attachment with a girl in Yall.
which helped happily to divert my attention both from being unemployed and from doing anything to rectify it. However, this sustaining situation cast a discomforting hue across Christmas as I realised my improper state, which hasn't changed by the way, would see me fall badly short when it came to celebrating the birth of Christ in every bar and town. So on November the 1st, my hopes and my chattels in a green rucksack, I boarded Slattery's bus for London, vowing to return by Christmas a wealthy man for at least 2 weeks. I quickly acquired a living bar job through the Tara Catering Agency in Paddington, a one-woman service operated by a woman called Nora from West Waterford. Nora dispatched me to a bar in the Holloway Road, where a 5.5-day week of 13-hour shifts awaited me. I'd been mangled by this system before, so it didn't surprise me. I would be the sole staff in a small L-shaped bar, where grim wallpaper and worn carpet didn't add to its attraction. The jukebox consisted of 50% Joe Dolan, 40% Brendan Shine, and the remainder for English people. The governor, as landlords back yonder are known, was a small man in possession of a huge stomach, several cheeks, a few chins, and a walk that seemed reluctant. His name was Tony, but everyone referred to him as Pig. But not too many if he says this. His wife Anne dressed in miniskirts and she carried a 1960s beehive hairstyle. She was seldom seen in the bar and, apparently, very seldom seen outside it either. They were childless, but they had an old lame sheepdog that seemed to be the wiser of the three. My lino-floored bedroom had a bed, a chair, a dressing table and a fan heater. I was summoned to work by a loud rap and the yell of 9 o'clock, you wait! On my first morning, I had my head out the second floor kitchen window conversing with a departing delivery man on the street below. I was oblivious to the pig's voice, until he roared in frustration. Your fucking breakfast is ready! Are you fucking deaf or fucking stupid? I must be stupid, I replied, or I wouldn't be here. To which he smiled, delighted. I like your smile. Good man, I like it. Thereafter, it seemed to be the norm, I always ate alone in the kitchen. My diet largely consisted of a combination from toast, boiled eggs, beans, bacon, cheese, fish fingers, steak and kidney pie, pork chops, ready mashed potatoes, peas and tea. I would be summoned to the kitchen by a bell to find it prepared on the table, courtesy of the elusive Mrs. Pig, who would either be absent or about to depart. She rarely spoke to me. Soon the dog and I had formed an empathy and began taking each other for walks after closing time. Saturdays were busy, and the rest of the week tickled by as casually as summer waves rolling onto your beach. In this vacuum of energy, I polished every glass and I dusted every shelf 20 times a week, while Joe Dolan professed his love for the girl in whitewashed gables incessantly. The clientele were small in number and mostly represented elderly locals and some younger Irishmen en route to livelier haunts. Occasionally, a few young girls happened by, but the jukebox and got rid of them. Most nights, the pig sat at the counter talking to friends, casting a caustic eye at any stranger who might alight on the premises. This was normal behaviour for governors and British pubs. One night, feeling I wasn't contributing sufficiently to dynamism, I hurled an ice cube into the air and caught it with a spoon and caught it in a spirit glass before I administered the whiskey. The pig's eyes nearly popped onto the counter. He broke from conversation to ask, with unconcealed awe, where I had learned that trick. Thereafter, his limitless admiration demanded that I repeat the maneuver whenever he himself wanted to impress somebody. I resolved never again to work for somebody who didn't go out. And then there was Harpo. It wasn't his real name, but his resemblance to the famous Marx Brother was uncanny. This was not merely due to his physical appearance, but, appropriately, he could neither speak nor hear. And he also had a glass eye. This is all true, by the way. I'm not sure if it is true. I know it is, actually, I swear. Harpo walked in a local restaurant. You couldn't make it up, for God's sake. Harpo walked in a local restaurant, but he spent much of the time in the bar playing cards. He possessed an amazing communication skill, whereby his hand and his facial gesture seemed to telepath his wishes. Now, Harpo was mostly loved, but sporadically ridiculed. One afternoon, a customer was evening his rather loping walk, when suddenly Harper turned and caught him in mid-gate. Embarrassed, the mimic began to apologise. Harper half turned away, scrunched his fist over his eyes, and then offered his irritant a reconciling handshake. The joker eagerly accepted, and a second later screamed in alarm as he discovered Harper's glass eye staring up at him from his pants. Harper, grinning widely, waved his finger in his face by way of an abomination. 2 weeks later, to circumvent the possibility of being instantly cast into a cold, dark night, I informed the pig by daylight that I was going home for Christmas. I'd stay a week to give him time to replace me. Like a couple whose relationship had settled for acceptance over ambition, we had grown to expect no surprises from each other, and this made him swear profusely. Then suddenly he mellowed, sighed, and said, "I should have known when I saw the rucksack that you weren't the man to stay put." A new barman, more determined than I to rid himself of Ireland, arrived twin days. I hoped the dog would understand. Thank you.